Welcome to what was going to be for our convention, our banquet speech. And Paul Clement has graciously agreed to do this now, fitting in better with our program. Paul is a partner at the DC office of Kirkland & Ellis. He's had an incredibly distinguished legal career. He is not 90 years old, although to look at him, you'll realize he's not. But it would sound like he is because he served for 5 years as the United States Solicitor General. But he has had an extensive career in the private sector as well. He's argued over 100 cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. There are only 10 people who have ever done that. And many of them are considerably older than Paul, let's just say. And he's just been an incredibly well-respected leading litigator. He's currently a distinguished lecturer in law at Georgetown, in addition to his legal practice at Kirkland. He clerked for Justice Scalia and Judge Silverman. And without further ado, I want to welcome Paul and thank him for doing this. Paul?
Thank you, Gene. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for the kind introduction. I really wished that we'd all be together at the Big House for this event, but I have to say I had a little bit of a suspicion that maybe something would go awry, because as some of the organizers knew, I am a lifelong Wisconsinite and Badger fan, and the idea that a Badger fan was going to do the keynote in the Big House, there just seemed like something problematic about that. I also wish we could all be together in Ann Arbor, because it is one of the great sort of Big Ten college towns. But again, I will profess a slight preference for Madison, Wisconsin. Most of my reasons to prefer Madison are personal, growing up in Wisconsin, and I love the lakes. But I think there's one reason to prefer Madison that members of the Federalist Society should agree with me on, and that is the naming or namesake of the town. As best as I can tell, Ann Arbor was named after the wives of two of the founders of the town and a grove of oak trees, whereas Madison, Wisconsin was named after the father of the United States Constitution, James Madison. So I think Madison has Ann Arbor beat on that score. Speaking of Madison, what I really want to talk about today, given that the focus of the symposium is on the structural Constitution, is the separation of powers. In particular, Madison's Federalist 48, and in particular, the differences between the strengths of the relative branches of government today versus what Madison had in mind. I think if you look at Federalist 48, you will see that Madison was most concerned with the power that had been given to the new National Congress. In fact, he famously described Congress in Federalist 48 as the impetuous vortex to which all power would be sucked into but for the separation of powers. And he was particularly concerned about Congress because of the power of the purse. As he wrote, quote, "It alone has access to the pockets of the people." The executive, by contrast, was less of a concern for Madison because, as he wrote, it is, quote, "restrained within a narrower compass and is more simple in its nature." And the judiciary was even less of a concern for Madison, as he said, quote, "it is described by landmarks still less uncertain," by which I believe he meant the case and controversy requirement of the Constitution. Together, Madison was sufficiently concerned with the Congress and sufficiently unconcerned about the executive and the judiciary that he wrote, "projects of usurpation by either of these departments, the executive or judiciary, would immediately betray and defeat themselves." Congress, thus, in Madison's view, was not just the most powerful and most dangerous branch, but if you read Federalist 48 carefully, I don't think it's an understatement to say that Madison believed that the power of Congress was the raison d'etre for the separation of powers, that checks and balances were there largely to constrain Congress. As he wrote, quote, "it is against the enterprising ambition of this one department, i.e. Congress, that the people ought to indulge all their jealousy and exhaust all their precautions." So let's take a moment now to think about Madison's vision versus our present day reality. And I think what you see is that both the judiciary and the executive are more powerful than Madison envisioned, And Congress is certainly less active and less of the impetuous vortex that Madison had in mind. First of all, let's talk about the judiciary. I think the case for saying that the judiciary is more powerful today than James Madison conceived that it would be is a pretty easy case to make. I think it is true in the obvious sense that the Supreme Court of the United States today is deciding most of the most fraught and contentious issues that arise in society as a whole, from race to abortion to sexual orientation. All of these issues are being definitively resolved in the Supreme Court of the United States rather than in the Congress. I think this would not only surprise Madison, but I think it's fair to say that nobody designing a system from scratch would necessarily think it was a good idea to have these kind of issues decided by 9 unelected lawyers who serve with life tenure. And I don't think it's a surprise as a result that the Supreme Court nomination process has become as fraught with difficulty as it's become because of the power exercised by the Supreme Court. But I think the power of the judiciary vis-a-vis the other branches is underscored in less obvious ways too. I mean, right now there's a federal district court judge in Ohio that's attempting to solve the nationwide opioid crisis, armed with tools no more specific than the state law of public nuisance. And that federal judge tackling a national problem with very minor and meager judicial tools is not alone. There's another federal judge in California that's trying to address the problem with youth vaping. And there are other federal judges who are being implored to address the global problem of climate change, if it is a problem. At the same time that the judiciary is plainly exercising more power than Madison would have imagined, the executive, too, I think, is more powerful than he would have imagined. Now, in saying that, I don't mean to really get into the debate about the unitary executive and whether the current executive is exercising the executive power that he's been given, say, by the Constitution, in a way that's similar to or different from what the framers had in mind. What I really have in mind is how much authority has been delegated to the executive branch by the Congress. I think you see this very dramatically in the current coronavirus situation, because I don't think it's an overstatement to say that in dealing with this crisis, all eyes are on the president. And to be sure, Congress worked with the administration to enact an emergency spending measure that had some minor provisions that went beyond spending to address some substance. But I do think the interaction here has been telling. As far as I can tell, the principal legislative response to the initial administrative request for funding to deal with this crisis was to say, you didn't ask for enough money, and we need to give you at least twice as much as you asked for. Now, that is an odd use of the power of the purse, to say the least, in terms of constraining the other branches of government. But I think you can find more mundane examples as well of the executive tackling lots of issues that James Madison probably would have thought would be dealt with by Congress. One that I've run across in my own practice is a recent effort by the FCC to reallocate spectrum in order to give a jumpstart to the 5G revolution. Now, the 5G revolution is obviously an important issue that should be wrestled somewhere in the federal government. But the idea that it's the FCC that's doing this without any specific direction from Congress does seem somewhat anomalous, especially when you understand that the reallocation of the spectrum is a matter worth literally tens of billions of dollars, some of which may be generated for the federal government fisc through an auction of the spectrum, but all of which is going to be allocated from some parties to others. And that does seem, especially given the stakes, classically something that James Madison would have thought that Congress would have dealt with. But the biggest surprise to Madison probably would be less that the judiciary is more powerful and the executive is more powerful, but that Congress has largely yielded past the other branches and is anything but the impetuous vortex that he feared. There are plenty of examples of this. I'm going to just pick very briefly a couple of obvious examples and then a couple of slightly more obscure examples just to illustrate that it's a broad scale problem. The most obvious examples I'll pick are two: immigration and the authorization for the use of military force. Immigration is clearly an issue that the federal government should be dealing with in the main, and there's no doubt that there have been great controversies about the right immigration policy. Now, perhaps it is precisely because immigration policy is so contentious and divided between the parties that there hasn't been a congressional solution. But at the same time that Congress hasn't changed the immigration laws in a material respect, we've seen very different executive branch policies from the last administration to the current administration. And we've seen individuals caught in the middle, for example, the Dreamers, who were allowed to stay in the country under the Obama administration, despite an arguable lack of legislative authority for that, and the question of whether the executive has the power essentially to simply reverse that policy is currently before the Supreme Court. The authorization for the use of military force passed in September of 2001 is another, I think, good example. There you had a situation where the attacks of 9/11 did prompt Congress into action and bipartisan action, and they acted in a way that gave substantial authority to the president, which was probably perfectly appropriate in the wake of those attacks. And so the authorization for military force broadly authorized the use of force for those individuals and groups responsible for the attacks of 9/11. What is striking is not what Congress did in that first week after the attacks, because they did act quickly, and this was sent to President Bush's desk for signing by September 18th, 2001. What is surprising is that Congress really hasn't revisited the issue, even though the war on terror has changed in many different respects and is largely become a war against ISIS, which is not a group that even arguably existed in that form at the time of the attacks of 9/11. But Congress has seen fit to largely just leave that authorization for use of military force in place unchanged. There are less obvious aspects, though, here too, which is why I think it is quite a widespread phenomenon. One of the most important concerns and developments of the last couple of decades, and one would think one of the principal objects of congressional action, would be the development of the internet. But yet, if you look at the congressional laws that principally regulate actors on the internet, many of them, many of the most important ones, such as Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act or the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, were passed in the 1990s. The difference, particularly in the context of the internet age, between the technology of the mid-1990s and today is a huge chasm. Yet many of these issues are being dealt with by laws that were passed in the very earliest days of the internet. To pick one other fairly mundane example, but I think shows the phenomenon pretty well, take the Telephone Consumer Privacy Act, the TCPA. This was a statute passed in 1991 to address one of the annoyances of 1991, namely being interrupted in the dinner, family dinner, with your landline phone ringing because some telemarketer was using an auto dialing machine to dial your home phone. Now, Congress passed a statute that largely outlawed the use of those auto dialing machines for those purposes. But here, nearly 30 years later, the technology has moved substantially. People are much more apt to get an annoying text than they are to get an annoying call. And they probably won't get the call to their home landline phone, but will get it to their smartphone. But yet, in all these years, Congress has not revisited the statute. And you now have a situation where at least the Ninth Circuit has interpreted the statute as providing that even a smartphone may well be an automatic dialing machine. And all of this is being done at a point where, instead of Congress revisiting the issue, if anything, they are waiting for the FCC to promulgate a new rule. So what are the consequences of this overly cautious Congress in terms of the separation of powers? Well, first, it definitely has an impact on the other branches. I think its impact on the judiciary is well illustrated just by looking at the cases before the Supreme Court this term. I'm not going to go into the details of the cases, but just to tick off three of the major cases that the Supreme Court is dealing with this term, all of them ultimately stem from relative congressional inactivity. One is the DACA case about the state of the Dreamers and whether or not they can stay in the country. Another is the two cases or three cases consolidated to deal with the question of whether Title VII and its prohibitions against discrimination based on sex apply to sexual orientation or transgender status. And the last of these cases is the case involving the Little Sisters of the Poor. And that's a case where, again, what is going on is that that the court is considering the validity of a major change in policy by the executive branch. And it's worth noting that in the Little Sisters case, this is a byproduct of the Affordable Care Act. And if you were going to identify one area where Congress hasn't been quiet in the last decade and a half, I suppose it would, you would point to the Affordable Care Act as being an example of major legislation, though not major bipartisan legislation. But even that major legislation left many contentious issues to the executive branch. And in particular, the question of whether or not there should be a mandate to provide contraception, as opposed to just a preventative health mandate, was left to the executive branch. And trying to resolve how that contraception mandate would interact with the Religious Freedom Restoration Act was, again, an issue that Congress didn't decide directly, but left to the executive branch. And so the Obama administration did relatively little to accommodate religious exercise, and its executive orders were challenged on those grounds. And now the Trump administration has done much more to accommodate religious exercise, and its efforts to accommodate religious exercise have been challenged under APA grounds, and that will all go before the Supreme Court. So the effect on the court's docket has been obvious. The effect on the executive branch has been equally obvious in that many important issues are being decided today by executive order. And I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that in some respects we have a government by executive order, which of course creates the dynamic that when there's a change in administration, there's one set of executive orders goes out the window to be replaced by another set of executive orders. And that's fine if it's matters of executive policy or intra-executive interpretation. But when it comes to matters as important as religious freedom and immigration, that certainly puts a lot of pressure on the system. But probably the biggest impacts of Congress's lack of activity are on Congress itself. And I think there are two things that I would point to. One is, I think by legislating relatively little, particularly on important issues, Congress and members of Congress have lost the art of the compromise. Legislation by its nature requires compromise, especially if you're going to legislate down to the details. One way to avoid compromise is to legislate about what you can agree on and kick everything else to the executive branch. But if Congress is actually going to legislate down to the details, it has to compromise. Now, compromise is not always easy, and it's not always fun. I worked in the Senate for a couple of years for the then junior senator from Missouri, John Ashcroft, who had previously been the governor of Missouri. One of his favorite quotes from that time that still sticks with me is he said that somebody who tells you that being a senator is as much fun as being a governor will lie to you about other things as well. Now, what he meant by that, of course, was that an executive can get things done through the executive dispatch and by acting quickly. Legislating, by contrast, requires many iterations of the law and compromise. The second thing that's lost besides that art to compromise, though, is that with less activity in Congress and more activity in the executive branch, there's a natural tendency for that to reinforce partisanship and for members of Congress, since they aren't acting through legislation as much themselves, to get themselves into one of two roles. If the president is from the same party as the member of Congress, they tend to cheer on what the president is doing through executive orders. And of course, if they're from the opposite party of the president, they tend to spend most of their time criticizing what's being done through executive orders rather than legislating, or at least legislating in a way that leads to signed legislation. And this creates a dynamic that I think was aptly described by Jonah Goldberg as producing a parliament of pundits, where instead of spending their time legislating, many of the members of the legislature are instead reduced to being armchair commentators on what the executive is doing or not doing. So I want to finish with a caveat and then a few thoughts about the path forward. The caveat is, I don't mean to be heard as saying that congressional action for its own sake is any kind of good thing. There is certainly something to be said for a do-nothing Congress, and in particular, there's something to be said for leaving issues to the states through another structural protection of federalism. But my point is simply that given what's going to be done on the federal level, the fact that so much of it is being done by the other branches and not by Congress is something that I think would very much surprise Madison. Now, in terms of the path forward and whether things can be made any better, I guess I'd make two sets of observations. One is that the courts can certainly play a role in trying to create better incentives for Congress to act. And perhaps the most promising prospect is the idea that the court may be on the verge of trying to revive the non-delegation doctrine. That's suggested by the opinions in the Gundy case and by a separate writing by Justice Kavanaugh, who did not participate in the Gundy case. And so that prospect is one thing that could certainly do something to revitalize Congress's legislative role. Another thing that the courts could certainly do is adhere to principles of statutory construction that minimize the incentives for Congress to simply kick issues to the executive branch or to the courts. I mean, the idea that the state of Title VII's application to sexual orientation is going to be decided by the Supreme Court rather than by Congress is something that is a little bit surprising. But I will say, if you think that the ultimate problem to this solution is that for the courts to do more, then I think you will have missed the first part of my speech, where part of the issue here is that the judiciary is much more powerful than Madison could have imagined. But I think you'll also miss at least Madison's view of how the separation of powers are supposed to work. Because as he wrote in Federalist 51, the key to the separation of powers is ambition must check ambition. So there really is no substitute for Congress itself trying to assert the authority to actually legislate in areas and not simply delegate to the executive branch. As Madison wrote, each department must have powerful motives to resist encroachment by the others. So what can Congress do in this respect? I will say I'm not an expert on that particular issue, but I do have some thoughts, having spent a couple of years in the Senate and having spent a lot of time watching Congress operate vis-a-vis the other branches. I think one thing Congress can do is try to revisit issues where technology and other advances have really overtaken the legislation on the books. Things like the internet and the TCPA provide examples where Congress could usefully revisit an issue where technology has rendered the statute largely obsolete. Another possibility is that Congress could try to essentially force itself to revisit some issues by imposing sunset clauses in legislation that forces them to revisit the issue every decade or so. Those sunset clauses also happen to have the additional virtue of protecting liberty by making statutes essentially expire if they're not renewed through the democratic process. And the last thought, which is perhaps more inside baseball and maybe more controversial, is there may be something to be said for giving greater power back to some of the committees of Congress so they can have the kind of expertise you need to deal with some of these new issues, where the temptation today, I think, is to think, well, we have experts for that in the executive branch, we'll just defer to the executive branch. But just to close, my point again is not so much to say that Congress needs to do more, but to point out that we have a system of separation of powers that was largely premised on the notion that Congress was going to be an impetuous vortex. And when we have a situation where Congress is perhaps the least active or the least self-aggrandizing of the branches, that may be a situation that would certainly surprise James Madison, and is not something that all of our institutions are perfectly well designed to address. So if there, those are my thoughts that I wanted to share, and if there are questions, I'd love to take one.
Thank you so much, Paul. We do have a question from Christopher from BYU, asks, if Madison has envisioned the judiciary's vastly expanded power, what additional checks and balances would he push for? Should there be more checks on the Supreme Court's power?
So it's a great question, and I appreciate it. You know, I do think that it would be hard for Madison to imagine exactly how we've gotten where we've gotten. But if he were going to sort of reverse engineer it, I think there would really be essentially two ways to come at this. One would be to try to kind of really instill in the judiciary a philosophy of restraint. And, you know, I think if you look at the jurisprudence of Justice Scalia, for example, the reason he was so focused on trying to come up with methods of the Constitution that were not just legitimate, but tended to restrain the policy preferences of the judges, is he thought that was the only way of judging that was really consistent with the system that we had and the independent judiciary that Madison helped design. I think, so what it really comes down to is, if you think that it's possible to restore a vision of judging that's consistent with that, that would be probably Madison's first best solution. But if you get to a point where Madison looks at that and thinks there's just no practical way to get to that result, given where we are in the system, I think, as with other parts of the Constitution, he would have tried to come up with some kind of structural restraint, some kind of structural approach to the issue. I don't have anything perfect in mind, but I do think, given the role that the Supreme Court plays today, you know, an idea like an 18-year term where each president would have the opportunity to nominate two justices in kind of a forced way does have something to recommend it. I don't think Madison would view that as the first best solution. I think he would say the first best solution is judges should go back to those well-developed hallmarks of the judicial role that he referred to in Federalist 48. But as the second best solution, some kind of structural limitation like that probably would have recommended itself to Madison.
Thanks. It's also interesting that Congress also has the wrong incentives in terms of they don't want to make decisions, and that's probably one of the factors there. We have a question which warm your heart, from Nicholas, who's a 1L at Michigan. It warms your heart because he's from Cedarburg, Wisconsin.
That's awesome.
But he says, it stinks we could not meet at the law school. My question is, how much of our current legislative malfunction relates to the 17th Amendment?
So that's a great question, and it's obviously something that was explored, I think, in one of the earliest panels. And I do think that, you know, when you look at the situation today and you say, well, it's different from what Madison had in mind, you know, one reaction is to say, well, Madison just, you know, lacked a certain amount of vision. Now, I'm less inclined to that view. And I think, you know, part of the view is maybe subsequent changes to the structure of the Constitution were made that contribute to where we've gotten. And certainly the pre-17th Amendment Senate that was envisioned by Madison, I think probably would have been quite useful in terms of prompting greater congressional action. I think that's probably true for two reasons. One is that I think that greater direct representation from the states would have just put the Senate in a position where it looked at issues differently and probably would create a dynamic where the senators could agree across party lines more readily on certain issues, because the state interest would be kind of paramount in their mind. So I think it'd probably be easier, just to take a good Midwestern example, to take for Wisconsin senators, Minnesota senators, and Iowa senators to agree on an initiative about agriculture policy across party lines if they were more directly representing the interests of their states. The second thing that I think would have an impact, and this may be part of the puzzle here and also part of what Gene alluded to, is if we envision the pre-17th Amendment Senate being put in place largely through the state legislatures and not through some sort of direct election process where they need to go through all of the kind of electioneering and fundraising that typifies the House races, you might have a certain ability to tackle some of these issues that are more divisive or, frankly, more mundane. I mean, part of the problem I think for, as a practical matter, for senators and representatives today, is their incentives in terms of getting reelected mean that certain issues where you probably could forge a legislative compromise kind of aren't worth getting involved in, because they're just not the kind of things that are going to help you in your reelection. And obviously a pre-17th Amendment Senate could be very differently positioned from that standpoint.
Probably needs to be our last question, but a student from NYU asks, do you think that an expanded, robust interpretation of the presentment clause can be an ancillary way of reviving non-delegation?
It's an interesting thought. I mean, I do think that focusing on the text of the Constitution and the process that Congress had in mind, or the framers had in mind, is always a great starting point for thinking about sort of developing the non-delegation doctrine. I think what has always puzzled the court in trying to implement the non-delegation doctrine is a little less from whence it comes, and I think the presentment clause would be a perfect place to locate it, but it's a little bit more in terms of how do we make this administrable. And I think, Justice Scalia, who I think had a lot of sympathy for non-delegation principles, but in a number of his separate writings, he always expressed frustration in the ability of the judiciary to come up with sort of manageable standards for applying the non-delegation doctrine. And I think if the court does revive the doctrine, that's really where the principal activity is going to have to be. And sort of the challenge for both academics and advocates will be to try to present those cases in a way that suggests that there's a judicially manageable role for the court to play in this area. But I do think the stakes are very high. And I do think that both constitutional texts like the presentment clause and some of the dynamic that I've outlined today are why it would be very, I think, helpful for the court to move in the direction of revitalizing that doctrine.
Thank you so much, Paul. Really appreciate it. And appreciate your adjusting to the circumstances. A very, very interesting talk about, definite challenges that lie ahead. And thank you.
My pleasure.
And with that, we will adjourn till 1:30, which is when our next panel begins. Thank you so much.